Spark, stories from advocates for global change, a podcast from the Swiss Young Academy.
Welcome to Spark, a podcast that shows career paths that help solve global challenges. I'm Julia, and with me today is Zora.
Hi, everyone.
In the next three episodes, we are going to talk about social media and its role in democracy. What role does social media have in your life?
Personally, I am not a very active user, yet even I realize that it still has a big impact in my daily life and how opinions are formed. For example, in my friend group, many people gather all their information on current political subjects on social media simply because we don't have time to read a whole newspaper article or listen to a whole discussion on the radio.
Yeah, I can very much understand why people resort to social media as a source of information. It's quick and convenient, but the quality might be questionable sometimes. So if someone gets their information exclusively from social media, that could be problematic, especially if they make important decisions, such as who to vote for. So it makes me wonder how big the influence of our consumption of social media on democracy really is, and also what role disinformation plays in it. How can we fight it? Do we need more regulations for social media? And finally, how should we act as users? What can we do?
So to answer these questions, we talked to three different experts on the topic. Firstly, Anna Jobin, a social scientist who will discuss, amongst others, the ban of social media for under 16-year-olds in Australia. Then Sophie Timmerman, a journalist who battles false information, such as, for example, the Russian propaganda, which is pretending to be the credible media outlet Spiegel. And lastly, Tommaso Venturini, a social scientist researching internet subcultures and how we should probably call conspiracy theories conspiracy folktales.
Our first guest on the topic of social media and its role in democracy is Anna Jobin. She is a senior researcher and lecturer at the Interdisciplinary Humanist Institute at the University of Fribourg. She's also the president of the Swiss Federal Media Commission and a member of the Swiss Young Academy. But before becoming an academic, she has followed quite a diverse career path.
That's right. So she founded her own company for consulting on social media and creating accounts for organizations. This has provided her with a lot of hands-on experience before going into the academic environment. One of her research focuses today is on algorithmic systems. She does this research with her multidisciplinary background in sociology, economics, and information management. Let's listen to her story.
She was in conversation with our co-host, Tanish.
I'll just wait.
Let us know when to start.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your background and how you came to work at the intersection of new media and society?
How long do I have for that? Because I never thought I would end up in research anyway. Even when I was young, when I was a kid, I didn't even really know what research was because I knew no one from my family who had been to university before. And so all of this was very unknown to me. But I've always liked school. I was one of these kids, yes. I liked school. I liked learning. And so I just went to high school and then I went to college. I never thought I would go to university. I had a career break in between where I did something different, but I missed learning more. And so I decided to go to university at one point. And then from there, it's just... I learned this big world of academia that there is.
How do you use social media yourself?
So from the time when I was this solo entrepreneur with my social media consulting, well, of course, at that time, it was kind of mandatory to also have a big social media presence. And so I had accounts on most of the platforms at that time. I started my blog at that time and was quite active. And when I went back to university, I was one of the most visible people at the university because I already had all these accounts, whereas many of my colleagues, that was not their first worry, right? Is to be visible on social media. That's not part of the main responsibilities of a researcher, especially not 15 years ago. Some who were even suspicious, right? If you can write a tweet, which at that time was 140 signs, how can you be a good researcher and actually understand the complexity of the issues, right? I have never seen that as a problem because it's just a different way of communicating. And it's not just communicating. I also read and learn a lot. And actually, much of today's network in academia is from the time when I connected to these people through, at that time, Twitter. And so I still think very fondly of that time in social media. Nowadays, I'm a bit less active.
Your research spans several critical areas, such as algorithmic systems and AI governance. Can you explain how these areas interact and why they are important?
Yeah, that has to do with how I got into this area. I started being interested in everything digital, but from the perspective as a sociologist. And around maybe 15 years ago, so when I started working on my dissertation, that was probably best expressed through the notion of algorithmic systems, like digitally connected algorithmic systems. No one was talking about AI in the big public discourse, right? Although, I mean, most of the technologies we call AI already existed. They have been existing for a long time, but more behind the scenes than they are now. And so that is probably why, because the common thread through it all, whether you name it algorithmic system, the digital spaces, social media, AI, is the fact that the way these technologies work and the way they blend communication and the transmission of information with our social life, that's quite inherent in them.
How do you think social media plays a factor? You know, what are your thoughts on how it influences our, you know, daily lives, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably ask back, name any aspect of life that has not been impacted by social media. Can you name one?
I can't.
Right. And I do think that even if we want to make the distinction between offline and online, and there are good reasons to do that, and there are other reasons why that might not be as relevant or not as clear, this distinction. But if we make that distinction, we can even argue and see how in the so-called offline world, a lot is impacted by what happens on social media. And there are many small examples of that. For example, that even people who don't have a smartphone or who don't have a social media account, the companies who run the social media platforms, they know about their existence because they are still on the pictures that might get uploaded or that might be authorized to access by these companies. The phone number of these people might still be in the address book of a mobile phone where these companies have access to, and so forth. So you cannot exist without being known by digital media. And that's just one of the examples, right? And then you can see how in this, I like to call it networked society, how these digital networks, well, of course they influence all aspects of our life, how we get information, how we share it, how or where we travel, where and how we work, and so forth and so forth. And so I find it then really interesting to also see how do people make sense of these changes and what changes do they themselves bring to the table when they are confronted with these technologies.
Coming back to the topic of influence, everyone, everywhere, all the time they talk about algorithms, social media algorithms, and how they are shaping public opinion, but no one really knows how these algorithms work. Could you share some insight on that?
I can try, and I can try on two issues that you raised. One of them is this systems themselves, how they work, and the other one is on their influence. And so how they work, as you said, it's hard to know for several reasons. Like one of the reasons is the fact that except for Wikipedia, all the other big known internet platforms, social media, but also search engines or other providers of services like blogs and sharing and so on, those are for-profit companies. And so they might have patents on their technologies. And so they, except for the patents themselves, but how they construct then their digital infrastructure cannot actually be known. We don't know the source code, right, of the operating systems of the digital platforms. Now, and that's the second point, why they are so obscure. Even if we saw the source code, I'm not sure it would actually give us all the information we need to really know how they work. And neither do all of the engineers working at these companies, because what you also have is the data that gets ingested into these companies. And so when you put those two together, those are immense, big, massive amounts of the data ingested into very complex interlinked systems. And so it's very hard or impossible to trace the input to the output.
Recently, Australia has banned social media for under 16s. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think such law should be implemented worldwide, or is it a bit too far, prohibiting children from accessing social media?
The Australia social media ban is a really interesting example of trying to do the right thing but getting it completely wrong. The Australia social media ban wasn't, well, at least not publicly, and from everything we know, even by reading, it has never been motivated by privacy worries or data protection issues, but it was motivated by worries about mental health issues of young people. Now, don't get me wrong. Young people's mental health is really, really important. And I do think there needs to be put in place whatever measures that we know that can help young people, especially with mental health issues, to find help and to get help and to get better. Banning social media has never been proven to work, because usually that's not actually the cause of mental health issues. There are some studies that show that young people who already do have some mental health issues are also heavy users, or tend to be rather heavy users of social media as well, compared to their peers. Now, that's a correlation, that's not at all a causation. And more qualitative studies who actually go and talk to young people and ask them what their worries are and what they feel is important to them, rarely social media is a problem. Usually, well, not usually, but often it might even be some sort of resource of help. So big country like Australia, I'm no specialist on Australia, but you have a huge country with a few cities, and it might be hard to access, if you're in a rural area, to access centralized services, for example. I know the same problem in rural America, for example, where social media has, and the connection to the internet has proven to actually help young people find some support online, find peer groups who help them make sense of how they are, and also find information about their condition. So the social media ban in Australia, and I really, really also lean a lot of the work by colleagues, even a lot of colleagues also from Australia themselves, who have been researching social media for a very long time, who are heavily against the measure that has been taken in order to solve a problem that would best be solved differently.
You have also done research on conspiracy theories in the past. What insights can you share from your work on conspiracy theories and misinformation in digital media?
Yeah, thank you for this question. I really must address that I have played just one part in this project on conspiracy theories and narratives that were led by my colleague, Dr. Sabrina Kester from the University of Zurich. From my perspective, what I'm interested in is how misinformation spreads online and what is the so-called socio-technical part in this. What does it mean? Socio-technical means the part where human action and technology melt together. So, for example, what a platform does to generate likes. So what is really put as a good example of content and then is shown to many people and we get many likes will then be spread further more easily. But that's not just because of the piece of content. It's, of course, also of how the platform is structured. And content creators know this. So content creators use this to their advantage, whether they do have beauty blogs, whether they have travel blogs or recipes or are other types of influencing, but also nefarious actors who want to spread misinformation also use this to their gain, to really, in a way, game the systems and make their content in a way that the socio-technical structures and that it is what the platform will then valorize and spread quickly to other users. Or another example is, and we have examples from around the world, is not just on social media platforms like TikTok or X or Instagram, but also on messenger services. And we've learned the important role that Telegram or WhatsApp play in the spread of conspiracy narratives or misinformation. But not only, right? Also, good information is spread. But it's much harder to then correct something once it's wrong. And I think it was Brazil who put in place a new law that made WhatsApp limit to how many people a message could be sent at a time. I think it was only to 5 people and you couldn't send it to hundreds of people at the same time anymore, which of course slows down the spread of any type of information, including misinformation.
Are there any policies that are in place to regulate the flow of fake news on social media? Because as you know, traditional media outlets that we spoke about are very regulated by the government. Are there any policies being taken by the Swiss government or by EU governments to limit fake news in social media?
One of the newer challenges with disinformation and misinformation has been the fact that it's usually information that can be found to be almost correct, but with a twist. So, for example, a quote, somebody has actually said something, but it's really just this sentence and it's out of context. And if you read the whole thing, it means something different than if you just read this one sentence. So it's very hard to fact check. And that's also where we will not be saved by AI who would then fact check whether that person actually said that. They would find yes, but it doesn't mean the same thing, right? And now, so what do we do? Let me start maybe by what we don't want to be doing. We don't want to have a Ministry of Truth. Ministry of Truth, and in George Orwell's 1984 novel, that was actually the ministry that spread the most lies. And so, but let's pretend we would have a Ministry of Truth. That would mean there's a government or a government agency actually deciding on what is correct information and what is not. In the best case scenario, that is a very diligently operating agency who, to the best of their knowledge, would then certify some information as being truthful and others not. In the worst case, the government would use this to their own gains, of course, and could then label as false claims by their opponents. It's very, very, very difficult, and usually so. The ideal of Western democracies was to make a separation between the information, how people get their information and the diversity, and the government. And that's why a free media, free press has been such an important ideal in the idea of democracy, is the fact that there is journalism, there are media organizations who will produce and verify information and spread it to the people, and people can get different types of news from different types of media, and then they can make their own opinion about the topic at hand. But then how do we know that they are trustworthy? And now that's where it gets interesting, is that why or how do we trust any institutions? And we've seen that that's very different in countries where people have a high trust in democracy, as opposed to countries where people have a low trust in their government as being democratic. So to them, some social media platforms seem more trustworthy to actually get the information from than in the countries who say, no, our democracy is more or less working. And so the big problem is rather disinformation that we see on social media.
For example, my Instagram feed, it's full of political messaging that's targeted towards young people. What are your thoughts on this? How do these algorithms, you know, kind of shape political opinion in young kids? And how does that, you know, propagate into further life?
Yeah, I do think that the information that we receive at any age, of course, also informs our opinion. But we know that impact is not as straightforward as I show you one thing and then you believe everything I say, especially with young people. I do think if it worked that way, parents would be very relieved. That means they just have to tell their young people one thing and it would work. No, I do think there's a baseline, you know, of critical thinking that that is usually present for all the people. What you talk about with, I don't know, platforms like TikTok, but not only, is then this whole mass of political messages and so on. So of course, if proportionately there's much more messaging on specific political stances more than of others, that might of course skew our perception. It's the scale, the mass, that can have an impact more than single messages. And then the algorithm, of course, we call it the algorithm. There's not one algorithm. But the way this information gets selected and sorted and then played out to you. And that's where we see that the platforms do have a responsibility, of course, in how they allow for different viewpoints to come together, in the way that they shape what you actually see. And a third aspect would then be purposeful manipulation, of course, of what you see. Some countries have many, many people working almost in a factory-like manner to post things online, to comment. Now we have, of course, the AI bots also doing some of that work, which makes then appear some opinions as being very, very mainstream, and they might be quite extreme. And if you ask the people that you know in your community, they don't hold extreme views. So as for the impact and manipulation, research has shown that it's not actually TikTok and social media radicalizing. What's much more important is traditional media, such as in the US, Fox News. We know that in the US, more people have been radicalized, polarized by Fox News than by any other medium.
So is it just a coincidence that this rapid polarization of people began around the same time TikTok and other social short-form content apps became more mainstream? Because me personally, what I've seen is when I was 14 and COVID hit, that's when TikTok and all these other short form video apps became really popular. And from what I've seen, the radicalization of people like going towards outlets such as Fox News and other outlets on the opposite side of the political spectrum, they started around that time. So is it just merely a correlation that TikTok came around the same time where I personally think the radicalization began? Or is it a causation?
It's probably more linked to the experience during COVID than the rise of the platforms. We know that COVID has been a very hard time for very many people for very different reasons. What we know is that the hardship that people experienced, of course, will then impact how or where they try to find comfort or not. Now, what we see on social media is that it's not necessarily what we understand, a traditional political debate, right? Where we bring the arguments and I listen to yours, you tell me mine, I tell me yours. And then people who listen to us say, oh, that's a good argument. I probably vote for this person or that makes sense. On social media, where people communicate and are linked with their friends and families and have connections and are building their also social identity, a lot of this information is then linked to how they define themselves and who we think we are. And if we blend the two together, I think that's something that is really, well, colleagues of mine have said that's quite new in these last two decades, probably. Whereas before, people would rarely define themselves, right, as this or as this politically. They were just different political topics and aspects, but it was less linked to the identity. And it helps when discussions that you might be having not on social media, where all the comments appear in more or less the same way, but they contain more or less harmful words. But when you talk to the people, that might be a different type of conversation because the format is different. And you might feel that the exchange also then happens a bit differently, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed that some people seem to have different opinions online than they do in person. And I never really understood where this, you know, difference in opinions began. So thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, but you see, that can also be a very positive aspect, right, of the online. I have another colleague doing research on young people and social media. And so when she talked about the social media ban in Australia, she made the point that banning young people from social media, that's not just inhibiting them from consuming some type of information, but also from expressing their opinion and from expressing their own point of views and from communicating, which might even like engrave their human rights, right? And if you look at it from that perspective, suddenly it's much more complicated than simply is social media good or bad, right?
So you're the president of the Federal Media Commission, who advises the Federal Council on questions about media. Can you describe the key objectives of the commission?
Yes, this commission, as you said, advises the Federal Council and the public administration in what, and that's very important, in this forward-looking manner in the area of media and communication services and platforms and in their role for democracy. So that is our main aim, is to really have this longer view on things and to maybe kind of do some foresight work on what is or what might be important, but sometimes also just to remind what is at stake already in the present. So in particular, of course, our commission, we support the right to diverse information and the free formation of opinions. In Switzerland, people go to vote 3-4 times a year, usually. And so it's very, very important to be able to have a diverse set of information about all the topics that you're supposed to be voting on. I mean, it's always important, right? But if we link then the necessity of an informed population to the direct democracy, the way the Swiss practices it, it gets even more crucial and you see the link immediately.
Are there any activities within the commissions that are specifically targeted towards young people and social media or any other digital media?
So in the Federal Commission of Media, We don't do any actions ourselves. We are like a bit of an advisory board. So we come together, we discuss what makes sense and why, and then we advise the government of sensible actions. So one of the points we keep making, as always, is the importance of media literacy for younger people, but not only younger people. I think everyone needs and deserves to be literate, right, in media and also in digital literacy. We also know that that's not only young people. So it's not a specific focus of ours, but of course, always also in our mind.
A quick note on media literacy. This refers to the ability to critically consume and analyze information that we receive from all types of media.
What would be your advice to people who are, you know, deeply invested in the evolution of digital technologies and its impact on society? How do I, as a young person, approach this topic?
So maybe coming back to my own story, I didn't know how to choose my topic of studies. And I chose sociology as a major, but I also chose political economy and computer science as minors. At that time, just because I was interested in these topics. And so I chose them and I had the deans sign off that, well, it's not unusual and it's not in our regulation, but if you really want to do it, why not? You can do it. And for over 10 years, I kept hearing by many people around me, yeah, but why did you do that? What's the link? And I even said, I don't know. I'm just interested in both. Well, fast forward 15 years later, and internet society, algorithmic systems and society is everywhere. And I get now invited to give talks about this topic. I have research projects on this very topic, the interlinction between the social and the digital. And I can get my add my expertise in the Swiss Federal Media Commission on society and digital technologies. But it was not foreseeable before that this was the way it would go, right? I could not have planned for that, probably. The institutions weren't ready for that. That was even 10 years ago. I still had encountered sociologists, professors of sociology, who would say, yeah, but still, this digital thing, that's just a side, that's a side arena. And in some ways, I understand what they mean. Of course, it's not, social aspects still matter very much, and we shouldn't forget about them and only focus on the digital, right? It's not just the digital that determines everything. But I also think we should not ignore it either.
So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
We heard Anna Jobin in conversation with our co-host, Tanish. And it is very interesting to me that she sort of got into this role of a pioneer in social media by chance, just by following her interests. And she really paved the way for such an important field. And what surprised me in a way is her statement on the importance of social media. We all have a certain idea, but to hear it from an expert is still a bit surprising, that even if you are not active on social media yourself, you are leaving footprints behind.
Yeah, so that is actually a scary insight. In my opinion, this connects to the responsibilities that these platforms have. On the one hand, on the protection of our data, and on the other hand, on the diversity of content that their algorithms select for. However, it seems that the interests of these platforms are mainly commercial and don't necessarily respect democratic values. I also found her perspective on the spread of misinformation really interesting. Who gets to decide what is wrong information? I think this really highlights the importance of independent media and press.
Mis and disinformation are so multifaceted that they are often hard to spot. And you can't just have an AI look at it. You still need real people who fact check. And one of these people is Sophie Timmermann, who we are talking to in the next episode of the podcast. She is a member of the media outlet Correctiv, and she fights mis and disinformation every day. So tune in next time to hear about Korrektiv and what it has to do with the Russian doppelganger mission.
So that's it for today. In case you are interested, there's a links for more information in the show notes. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Spark. Stories from advocates for global change. A podcast from the Swiss Young Academy. Hosted by Julia Knuchel, Tanish Shingli and Zora Althaus. Produced by the Podcast Schmiede.